Support for This Day in Esoteric Political History comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is an all-in-one management software with apps for every business need. Odoo has apps for CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, manufacturing, and everything in between. And they're all in one easy-to-use software. And the best part about Odoo? All Odoo apps are integrated, helping you get things done faster and more efficiently. So when you think about business, think Odoo. To learn more, visit odoo.com/thisday. That's odoo.com/thisday. Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, March 11th, 1959, the play A Raisin in the Sun debuted on Broadway in New York City. The play was based on the experience of growing up in Chicago in the 1940s, facing racism and discrimination and pursuing the American dream. It was that experience of the author Lorraine Hansberry, the first female African-American to write a play that hit Broadway. And get this, just 28 years old at the time that the play debuted. So, folks, what have you accomplished? But look, here to discuss the play, its political themes, its timeless political themes, and the remarkable short life of Lorraine Hansberry are, as always, Nicole Hemmer of Columbia and Kelly Carter Jackson of Wellesley. Hello there.
Hello there. I am feeling very self-conscious about my CV right now. I know, I feel like I'm 10 years late to be 30 under 30, but... Yeah. Hey there.
Yeah, exactly. Well, first off, let me say, Nicole Hemmer and Kelly Carter Jackson, also both contributors to the new newsletter that we're going to be doing here at This Day. I got to keep plugging that, especially the top show. So, folks, yeah, we are going to do a newsletter very soon, and we're going to share our thoughts and maybe our, you know, insecurities about what we've accomplished by the age of 30. If you want to sign up for a new newsletter, you can do that at our website, thisdaypod.com. But let's get into this. And, you know, there's so many big themes here, and the way that this play grapples with the American dream, and then some other wonderful sort of little stories to tell around it. But let's talk about the play as a play, both as sort of a plot and what it tackles, but also just as you know, a masterwork. But Kelly, you were telling us before we started recording here that your sister is a drama teacher who does this play all the time?
Yeah, my sister is a high school theater teacher. She has been for years. She's also been teacher of the year. Just want to throw that out there. Yeah. Anyways, she has done all of these plays with her students, and A Raisin in the Sun is one of them that constantly, you know, gets attention, wins awards. The play is really timeless because it tackles so many of the issues that we still grapple with today. So if you think about white flight, if you think about the American dream, if you think about feminism, and you know, the family all has this desire to achieve something, whether it's home ownership or becoming a doctor or, you know, accumulating generational wealth that can be passed down from one generation to the next. Like, there's so many big, rich political themes that are so ahead of its time in this play. It just makes it all the more incredible when we look at it through today's lens.
Yeah, that's the way that it plays around with this core idea of the American dream, especially in the 1950s, that it takes that idea and questions it and explodes it and expands it and looks at it in a way that it's just not often looked at in American literature, because so much of American literature is told from the white perspective of the American dream in the 1950s of a nuclear family and a home in the suburbs. And that's part of this dream too, right? To home ownership as a form of independence. But it's told in such a challenging and creative way.
Right. But, you know, like all great works of art, it also just works as a piece of drama with rich characters, interior lives. You know, that's the sort of engine of it, is this family that has moved into a new neighborhood, purchased a house, is pursuing all these dreams of both home ownership, assimilation, identity, careers, you know, kids trying to find themselves, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, we can talk a little bit about the many movies of this play that, you know, but it's one of these just texts, as you're saying, Kelly, that people return to every time they do it. It's just like, well, this is just really good. And, you know, and so, so yes, a lot of things try and tackle these big ideas that we've been talking about, but don't pull it off because they're not just sort of really well written and really well executed as plays. And so to that point, and since we're getting at the debut on Broadway here, you know, I'm curious, like, if you feel like it's makes sense that this made it because it's really well written and that this would be the first play on Broadway written by an African-American woman, it makes sense because it's really well written and it just sort of checks all the boxes in terms of good theater? Or is it like, mm-hmm. wow, how did something that tackles all these big issues sneak through?
It still blows my mind. It's radical that this is debuting on Broadway. I mean, Broadway has a long, deep history of racism, just to be blunt. And so the fact that she is a Black woman, think about how many Black women playwrights or women mm-hmm. playwrights there are in this moment. They're not a lot. And so and she's young. It's not as though she's been at this right. for decades and then, you know, finally has her moment to shine. She's not even 30. And so that in and of itself just seems remarkable that she could even get this to Broadway. But the fact that it's so successful, it resonated with audiences. It's one of the few plays that draws Black audience members to the theater, which I think has been a big thing as well. So many people have looked at theater as something that was upper crest. Mm-hmm. Very white, not attainable for other people to attend or to watch these shows. And so Lorraine Hansberry brings in a different demographic in presenting this play.
When you're describing that, it's interesting. It's making me think of another person who you and I at least have been thinking about a lot lately because it's part of the Oprah show that we're doing, but Toni Morrison, mm-hmm. right? Who, yeah. you know, again, wrote sort of very difficult stuff that was grappling with serious issues that then managed to break through and often cross over into white audiences. But of course, the story with Toni Morrison, one of the sort of critical stories with Toni Morrison, is she doesn't get that until she's in her 40s. You know, it's like late.
Yeah.
And so just to reiterate your point mm-hmm. here about how remarkable it is that age 28, after just really like, it looks like a year or so of being off Broadway, pre-Broadway, breaking through in this sort of mm-hmm. spectacular way. It's just even that much more remarkable.
Yeah, and I think that it speaks to just her. I mean, you asked the question of whether it was just such a good play. Yes, in a way. Like, it was mm-hmm. such a good play. And it was a proven success that the next play that she has that opens on Broadway is a huge success. So there is a way that the market tests out her talent and really demonstrates what a gift she had.
Yeah. Let's paint a little of the political context or just the social and political context around the themes of this. I mean, you know, home ownership. Mm-hmm. What is it to mm-hmm. take on the question, especially for a Black family, of home ownership in this is based, you know, the play debuts in 1959, but it's sort of based on Hansberry's experiences in the 40s growing up. We've talked about home ownership. We've talked about Black families in Chicago. You know, paint that larger picture.
Yeah. I mean, home ownership in Chicago, but let me say that Black home ownership in Chicago is so contested. And there's rich histories about this as well. There are great books about this as well. So many books have been written about Black Chicago home ownership. But because it's so contested, because there are these covenants that basically created neighborhoods that were white only neighborhoods, when Black people tried to integrate those neighborhoods, they were often met with violence. You know, Lorraine Hansberry's mother is basically armed with a pistol, ready to defend her children because Black homes were being firebombed or attacked or, you know, had their windows broken. And so there was a lot of threat of danger, knowing that if you were trying to integrate a white neighborhood, you were going to pay the cost for it. Or you would pay the cost for it economically, meaning white families would just leave altogether. And then you would be left with the neighborhood that has, you know, sort of no tapped in investment into that community. And so this was something that she's talking about, but she's also talking about what it means to be a homeowner and have an inheritance, mm-hmm. to pass something down. The plot of the story is around the patriarch who dies and leaves this inheritance money, which allows them to purchase this home. And so there's a lot to be asked about what happens with this money, how is this money best used, and how can we invest it to make it last longer than the members themselves.
Yeah, homeowners is one of the largest sources of intergenerational wealth in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so this period in which particularly Black Americans are being barred from either home ownership or being able to, as Kelly was describing, see their housing prices grow over time so that they would have extra money to pass on is a really important part of American history. And I think it's also important to, like, if you look at the legal history around these restrictive covenants, you notice that in 1948, the Supreme Court says that these are unconstitutional. You can't have these restrictive covenants that say you can only sell to white homeowners. But that doesn't mean that those restrictions go away. Instead, you have what Kelly's talking about with, if you don't have the deed that requires it, then you have real estate agents who won't show you the homes, or you'll face violence, or you'll have these blockbusting real estate agents who drive out all of the white homeowners. So it's one of those things where if you look at the Supreme Court law, you think equality comes in 1948, right. But of course it doesn't.
And there's, you know, all sorts of studies today that show that all those redlining and greenlining and so forth is still the legacy that still continues to today. You know, white neighborhoods remain white neighborhoods, and prices and all those things, sort of that legacy is still there. I mean, you know, I'm working on another project that sort of loosely touches on this idea of how the American dream was built in the 40s. And I've been thinking a lot about this, but, you know, this is just making me realize kind of like, I think it's obvious that like home ownership is like so central to that. And then of course, so like everyone, black and white, gets sold that sort of central idea, but then, you know, black people are kind of cut out from it. And so it's just this immediate concerted tension. Yeah.
Think about World War II and how people are coming back from war. And there's a lot of prosperity in the United States. There's a lot of wealth to go around. There's all these new technologies and industries, and people want the suburbs. The suburbs gets created in the 40s. I mean, if you think about Levittown and all of these places that have their origins in this particular decade, this is the moment I think that we think of the Make America Great Again, when we think of Leave It to Beaver and all of these nostalgic ideas about good times and ice cream cones and, I don't know, like green grass lawns and all of that stuff. That moment is now. And so Lorraine Hansberry is really problematizing a lot of this for her audience.
Back to the play itself and the run. It has over 500 performances in the initial run. I mean, one interesting thing worth pointing out is we've talked about it as bringing black stories to a traditionally white space, but it also brought black theater goers to Broadway, many for the first time as well.
Yeah, this is something that was often talked about when Hamilton got really big, the idea that suddenly there were people coming to Broadway who hadn't ever really thought about Broadway as a place for them. But as you see with Lorraine Hansberry, that she was doing the same thing back in the 1950s, that if you tell people's stories, then they want to come see them. Yeah. And that had been something that Broadway had really been lacking.
Can I also say that what I love about the play is that she doesn't sort of spend a whole lot of time in the stereotypes. She really looks at the interior lives of black people. This is something that Wesley Morris has written about as well, even though the Sidney Poitier's character is a driver, you never see him driving someone in the play. Like, he's in his home, you know, and they're having these really deep conversations about, you know, what they want to do with their lives and how they envision their own dreams for themselves. And it's a way that black people get to see themselves in all of their honesty and all of their authenticity. And I think that is something that's really beautiful about this play too.
And I think, as Kelly is getting at, there's this real emotional core, a rich emotional core to this story. And it's part of a longer conversation that's been happening among black Americans. The title itself, A Raisin in the Sun, comes from a Langston Hughes poem called Harlem that comes out, I think, in the 1920s. And he's asking, what happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun, or fester like a sore and then run? And then at the very end, he asks, maybe it just sags like a heavy load, or does it explode? And that idea that a dream deferred, by denying opportunities and possibilities to black Americans, that there's an explosion at the end of that. It's kind of it's almost the same kind of reference that you hear with James Baldwin in The Fire Next Time. And Baldwin, interestingly, is friends with Lorraine Hansberry. It's a rich, ongoing, decades-long conversation.
Kelly, do you have thoughts on that kind of, I mean, there's Baldwin, I mean, you just read about this moment that this play comes out and you think about all the remarkable characters who are in Hansberry's orbit.
There's so many people who are in their prime, who are in conversation with each other. It just makes me think about, you know, To Be Young, Gifted, and Black is a song that Nina Simone wrote that many people may be familiar with. But I was not familiar with the fact that she wrote it about Lorraine Hansberry, that it comes from Lorraine Hansberry. And there's a quote where Lorraine Hansberry had used in addressing like a creative writing conference. And she said, quote, "I, for one, can think of no more dynamic combination that a person might be." And then she goes on to say, "And that is why I say to you, though it be a thrilling and marvelous thing to be merely young and gifted in such times, it is doubly so, doubly dynamic to be young, gifted, and black." And just to hear her say this in this moment, to have so much pride and to see the beauty and blackness and combine that with youth and talent and skill. I mean, in a lot of ways, she's talking about herself because, you know, 28, but she dies at 34. But she has just done remarkable things in a short amount of time. And if anything, I think that should inspire us that youth is not a hindrance to be able to do these incredible things.
Yeah. So 1965, she dies of pancreatic cancer. Shortly thereafter, sort of a play that's of her unfinished works goes out, and that's called To Be Young, Gifted, and Black, and then Nina Simone picks that up. And I mean, you know, we could have probably just not done this whole episode and just told people, this is the person who Nina Simone wrote To Be Young, Gifted, and Black about, and that's pretty much all you need to, you know, that says so much, right? That's like talking about a legacy, right? Checked. But yeah, it is remarkable. Mm-hmm. And Ben Baldwin continues to just talk about her and so forth. And then, you know, as the play itself, it gets turned into movies, it gets revisited time and time again, and so it continues to just be this incredibly resonant work. One little tidbit as we wrap up. It has been revived a number of times in this century. Denzel Washington was in it on Broadway. Makes total sense. Mm-hmm. I did not know or realize, or maybe I'd sort of filed it deep back in my head, but apparently Sean Combs, Buffy, was the star of a revival of... Yeah, I don't know what he was calling himself at that moment. It changes fairly often.
I know, right?
But he was apparently the star of a revival of Raisin in the Sun as well. But I'm sure we will see more. And so, you know, we will continue to grapple with this work. Okay, as we wrap up, let's do a couple. We haven't done this in a while, not for any particular reason. We just haven't done it in a while. But some also on this days, so some other things that happened around this time. And you can jump in if you have thoughts, or we can just I'll just say them. But 1841, this is when the United States versus Amistad ruling came down from the Supreme Court that captive Africans who had seized control of the ship had been taken into slavery illegally. 1842, the first documented discovery of gold in California, the gold rush begins. And then 1861, I guess these are all in the mid-1800s, but 1861 was when the Confederate Constitution of the United States was adopted. And we did do an episode about that I actually, is one of the episodes that I think about the most. And it was really fascinating. So there's a plug for you. All right, that brings us to the end of the episode. Nicole Hemmer, thanks to you as always.
Thank you, Jody.
And Kelly Carter Jackson, thanks to you.
My pleasure.
We have all thought about your offer, and we've decided to move into our house because my father, he earned it brick by brick. Now, we don't intend to cause no trouble or fight no causes, and we're gonna try to be good neighbors.
Radiotopia.